everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of Constructive Criticism. We are not dead. We are alive, despite what the YouTube comments might say. We are here, and we are ready to attack Mason Clark.
I'm more of a defend kind of guy. You know, we're talking about TFT today, right? Teamfight Tactics?
No. Nope. Wrong.
Okay. Don't worry. Next week. Gotcha.
Nope.
Gotcha. Okay.
Nope.
Are you sure?
Nope.
All right.
Trey, save me.
I'm also ready to attack Mason Clark.
Wow. Okay.
You know who else is ready to attack is our patrons over at Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/ccmtg. Become a patron starting at any amount that you see fit.
Let them eat cake. That's what I just heard. They're ready to attack?
Yeah, Mason Clark. They're ready to attack Mason Clark. That's what we're learning.
I'm in danger.
What, you can't fight off 60 people? I don't understand.
No, I cannot. I don't know. I guess it depends. Like, do I have, like, a sword or something?
Why would that help? There's no way that you know how to use a sword other than you know not to hold the point in it. But you have no skills of any kind with a sword. You haven't done any training. I don't even know if you've seen a waterfall before. Like, you have no sensei. What would you do?
Stick him with the pointy end, Mason.
Yeah, first off, I don't have to win. I just need to make sure enough people don't come at me because they don't want to be the one that gets got. Because I can swing it. I can get one of you. But that's not here or there. We're getting really derailed here. So.
You know what doesn't derail us is our goal of always improving. Hashtag always improving is the point of the podcast. If you're not getting better, you know, you can be. Every week you can do something to try and improve yourself at the game or life in general. Trey, what have you done this week to try and improve at Magic?
Well, one of the things I've been able to do this week, which I have not been able to do a lot of over the last couple of weeks, is actually play Magic, which has been super fun. With M20 coming out on Arena, I have been spending way too much time trying to build a black-blue reanimator deck and having an absolute blast doing so. I've just been Agent of Treachering everyone's things. And it's been a lot of fun and trying to figure out like what the metagame is and what's going on in Standard right now, even though I don't really have any Standard events going on. That's been something that I haven't done in a while, where I've just been like playing Magic because it's fun. Like, I'm not playing for a specific event. I'm not playing to do a thing. I'm just like working on a deck and tuning a deck for no other reason than I like it. And that's been something that's been like invigorating, because we all get caught up in like the grind of just tournament prep and then tournament performance and then the next tournament prep and then tournament performance. But it's been great for just like a week to just play Magic because I like Magic.
Yeah, that's basically what I've done this week also is, you know, I got a GP coming up. And one of the cool things about GPs not mattering anymore is that you just get to, like, play the deck you love and try and do your best.
Aggressive. So aggressive.
I now understand all of Watsy's decisions up until this point. It all makes sense.
And, like, I'm so excited for this Grand Prix. I got to go to Denver, which has amazing food and amazing recreational activities. And,
oh, like,
you know,
escape
just
rooms?
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Nice.
And
mountain climbing.
And like kind of like you know, Trey, I just am so excited to just play a Magic. You know, I've been streaming more lately, streaming different decks that I'm preparing for the Grand Prix with. You know, looking at a couple different things. I'm pretty locked in on like some kind of green red deck. Weird. But yeah, it's pretty cool. Scapeshift is pretty high up there on my list right now, just as a deck that I enjoy. I played a ton of Gates before, and, you know, things come full circle. And we have a lot more tools to deal with that pesky Nexus deck now. So,
for sure. Also, I just, you know, like you said, Grand Prix don't matter, right? Well, I Nexus is so unfun. We talked about this a little bit. I just don't think a lot of people will bring it who aren't, like, super spiky. So,
right. Who's going to bring Nexus to an event that doesn't matter? Like, yeah. Come on.
Matt Nass probably will, because he lives there. And he loves probably doing... Actually, he'll probably do a Shard combo. So you're probably safe. There you go.
There you go.
Yep. My always improvement this week has been a little different. So I haven't been playing Magic.
Even a Magic player anymore?
I mean, I got my Mastery stuff done today. Like, I got that knocked out before we did the podcast. I got my, like, dailies done to work towards the unlocking stuff.
There you
Played some Vampires. You know, that was kind of impressed. But yeah, but I've been playing a lot of the game Teamfight Tactics, and my most improving moment is kind of like applying skills that I've learned from Magic when it comes to like learning something, figuring out the process, figuring out what matters, figuring out like what I should be doing, breaking stuff down, learning from people, and applying all that stuff and redoing it in Teamfight Tactics. And it's really great because it's kind of like I get to re-experience the early learning curve of a game and the things that I've done there and reflex those muscles. Because while you can like try to go back to basics and work on that kind of stuff with Magic, there is some part of it that's like for lack of a better word, like autopilot-y, we're like kind of defined already, you know? And I get to rework those kind of early muscles with Teamfight Tactics. And I'm having a great time. I'm getting to hang out with friends, make some new friends. Like, I got to play with Yo Man 5, and like, we like hang out at tournaments sometimes when we're there, but like, you know, it was nice just to talk to that guy and play with a different context and stuff and like pick his mind in that game. And I got to like play with Matt Kling, former co host of the show, and like, I got him addicted to Teamfight Tactics, and that's my fault, and I'm sorry, Matt. But, you know, just that kind of stuff.
You should be sorry to me. He's now messaging me about Teamfight Tactics.
Well, all I know is that Michael, rest in peace, messaged me saying, how do you play that game? And then he said, cool, I'm probably going to play with Matt later. I'll see how it goes. And that was like at 8. And then they told me they played till 6 a.m. the next day. And so they're pretty deep on it, you know. Always once a grinder, always a grinder. So.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Smash does this for me a lot, and I can really relate to it. You know, just breaking down a problem to its simplest form, and trying to improve at those micro areas in a game is so fun. And as you are new at a game, you get to see those rewards just kind of explode. And I don't know, it's a really fun feeling.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm still like flexing like similar muscles to Magic. Like it really is like a deck building drafting game. So it's been a lot of fun. I highly suggest that game to everyone. I don't want to make this a TFT podcast. That's coming to
you
that
do.
Soon.
That's a lie. You actually do. But you know who doesn't is our sponsor at Oasis Games.
Hello, fellow Magic competitor. If you're like me, and I think you are, then your heart is heavy with sorrow today. We often say the hour of death cannot be forecast. When we say this, we imagine this hour would be in a distant future. We never thought that we would be thinking of Bridge from Below as only a memory. Bridge seems so young. It all seems a bit unreal, but yes, while the end came a little sooner than we thought, it was not entirely unexpected. Instead of mourning what we have lost, just remember that we were all privileged to have the time with Bridge that we did. I encourage you at this difficult time to share your own stories of making loads of free zombies while playing a card that barely seemed like it was designed for Magic at all. Despite the loss of Bridge, I'm sure that we haven't heard the last of Dredge family. Zombies have a persistent way of not staying dead. In lieu of flowers, the Dredge family encourages you to get something for yourself. And what better place to do it than the wonderful folks at mtgoasis.com? That's right, head over to Oasis Games and use code CCMTG for 15% off your first order, and then you can use code WouldThatBeGood for 4% off every order.
Sorry, I was tearing up a little bit there during the thing.
Bridge has been a card longer than Mason's been alive, so let's just be very real about how long we had Bridge for.
Yeah, it's like when you know you're born, you have your family dog, and it passes away. It's like it's pretty rough on me today. Not gonna lie. Oh, thank goodness for the people at Oasis Games.
Yeah,
I ordered my Hogek and my Dredge cards. That way, I can still be a degenerate player. That's all I've ordered.
Did you actually?
I thought about it. Really? I think Dredge is probably really well positioned this weekend, but I have no events this weekend. So.
Fair enough. Speaking of things that could be well positioned, should we talk about our biggest mover?
Let's go!
Trey, what is your biggest mover this week?
Well, Mason just kind of hinted at it. Dredge. I think that this banning announcement actually does really make way for graveyard decks to be really abused right now, because everyone's going to be like, haha, the witch is dead, and they're going to take all of their graveyard hate, and they're going to free it up for sideboard slots for other things. And that's exactly the time when you should play a degenerate graveyard deck. And that, you know, while Bridge from Below is gone, there's still lots of degenerate stuff that you can be doing in the graveyard, whether that's going back to traditional Dredge builds or even just applying some of those principles to the Dredge Vine deck. Like, the Dredge Vine deck can play Prized Amalgam. The Dredge Vine deck can play Creeping Chill. Like, there are those kinds of things that you can still do in that, and it's going to be really broken and degenerate still. It's just you're not going to be turned to combo milling people anymore. So while this was hit and while that deck that was there is no longer going to be a deck, that doesn't mean that these cards aren't still a problem and that they aren't around. And I think that people are going to overreact to the banning and they're going to cut more hate than they should. And that's going to leave a position for Dredge to come back around.
Can I say that they're not even going to overreact? They're just going to react the way Watsy wants them to, right? Where it's like, oh my goodness, I get to cut my 9 graveyard hate cards, 6 of which were in the main deck, right? Like, they're just going to do what they're supposed to do. And the problem is, they probably cut maybe a little too much, you know? And then that's what happens. Because everyone, I'm tired of playing with all these Ravenous Traps and Surgical Extractions in my sideboard, in my deck. It's so frustrating. Like, so much of my deck is taken up. So.
And the tale is old as time. That's where the zombies are there to rise up again.
Yep. Dredge seems very powerful this week. Spencer, what's your biggest mover?
You know, I thought about this quite a bit today. And I think that my biggest mover is actually Wildgrowth Walker. This might be like, what? But Wildgrowth Walker decks have really tried to refine their foothold in the format since the printing of War of the Spark. You know, whether it's Dreadhorde decks or, you know, different style decks, they always seem to be just one Teferi away from losing. And, you know, while the thing that I personally in my heart of hearts wanted in a Teferi banning didn't happen today, I do think that Wildgrowth Walker is kind of in a better position today than it's been in a long time. Just the elemental decks having access to it as an elemental in addition to the explore package fix a lot of problems with maybe some of those more aggressive versions of the elemental decks, and it's something that you can look forward to, I think, seeing a little bit, depending on how good things like the big mana decks are in the form of Flood of Tears, Scapeshift, and Nexus. If those decks don't come out of the gates as some of the better decks, I think going wide slash big with Wildgrowth Walker elemental stuff could be a legitimate strategy in this format.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was playing the explore package in my elemental decks for Wildgrowth Walker, you know, and to like kind of control the early game, and it was powerful. Like, the deck just always plays magic, like we said, you know, last week on the set review. You just never don't play when you have that many explore creatures and Risen Reef and stuff in your deck and Cavaliers and whatnot. So
yeah, and I think that like while mid-range decks have been mostly mopey, I think that Omnath actually is a bigger get for like 4-color mid-range decks than I expected. I don't know. I just did not expect 4-color mid-range to be like a thing that I would be thinking about playing coming into this format after, you know, Esper was so efficient. But Esper didn't get a lot, and a lot of the other decks did.
Just briefly, while we're talking about mid-range, it's just something that I wanted to mention that I've discovered that I was really surprised at, is that Risen Reef and Paradise Druid and all of those X1 cards that are in all of these mid-range decks has also made, like Massacre Girl, like, surprisingly good, which is a thing that I would not have anticipated. But the fact that people are playing a 3-mana 1-1 makes, like, there's always something laying around to, like, get the chain started for that card. And that's, like, a weird thing that if you're building mid-range decks that are in a black color base, that's something that you might want to consider having available to you.
Yeah, I think that the Wildgrowth Walker deck even gets to play its own, you know, 1-1 for 3 mana that and Massacre Girl in the same deck. So it has random stuff flying around for it, which is pretty nice.
Yeah, it's like exactly what Trey said, except you're putting it in your deck, so now you enable your own Massacre Girls.
Exactly.
Which is, you know, different side of the same story. Yeah. So my biggest mover this week, it's going to be a surprise to no one, Primeval Titan. I'm just joking. No, I actually don't know if that deck's going to be good enough right now. I'm pretty excited for a couple things in Modern, but the thing I'm most excited for and my biggest mover down this week is Neoform. So the London Mulligan's out. We've got it. Hogak's gone, and it should be time for Neoform to like crush the metagame, right? Like, it seems like it's the perfect storm. It's going to be the next thing. I just think that deck isn't actually good enough after playing it some more and thinking about it and seeing it play out. And it's just gone down in my mind from something that, like, I'm kind of afraid, I want to see how this plays out, to, oh, I actually just don't think that this deck is consistent enough to be a real contender in its current iteration. And as such, I'm putting it down. I'm low on Neoform.
So what is that? Like, it's just too inconsistent?
Yeah, I just don't think it's consistent enough, and I don't think it interacts well enough against discard plus clock to like actually do enough in the metagame. I think it has a problem against like disruption just in general plus clock, and I think some of the best decks in Modern right now going in to this new metagame in my head are like Arclight Phoenix, humans, Dredge, and 2/3 of those interact with Neoform, between like Thalia is actually kind of hard for them to beat at times. Meddling Mage, you know, naming one of their things, or a Nourishing Shoal, for example, is pretty hard for them to beat. I think it's almost impossible in game one. Maybe there's a way where like they just have enough in hand to kill you, but I don't think there is.
My thought would be that that would make something along the lines of Mardu Death Shadow, like one of the bigger movers up. Just a deck that really has the ability to interact with opponents and not have to. I mean, because Jund, you know, though it's been having this resurgence, it has that resurgence because it gets to target just a couple of decks, you know, Blue White, Phoenix, and Hogak. Now that it doesn't get to do that, Jund loses a lot of its luster to me. And so a more streamlined, powerful deck like something like Mardu makes a lot of sense to me.
I'm curious because, you know, I played against Jeremy, who won the Open and is part of the Team Lotus Box house, you know, and they're like really high on that deck. And I'm curious if it was like, they said it had a really good Hogak matchup and he like apparently destroyed Hogak and they all did. So it seems like it was doing the same thing. I'm pretty sure the shell of like the new Ranger, Unearth, Death Shadows, and like interaction is probably good enough. But I wonder if Mardu is the version of that. You know what I mean? Maybe it's supposed to be Grixis. I'm not sure. But
you can't do Grixis if you want to play the Ranger, right?
I'm sorry. I meant Abzan.
Esper.
Esper. Sure. So sure. It's like there's like a couple different. You know, there's three different ways you can build your 3-color deck there that you could go, right? If you want to have white. I almost wonder, is that deck just good enough, or is it like Jund 2? Because to me, it kind of feels like what you were saying about Jund, except it has more raw power to it than Jund because of Death Shadow and Unearth combo. So,
I think that you need. I mean, you're substantially faster than Jund, right? Like. You're not playing Raging Ravines in your deck, which is a pretty big difference to me. You know, as somebody who likes those style of mid-range decks, I lean towards Mardu, but it doesn't mean that Esper isn't correct or that I haven't thought of Abzan. But, you know, Shadow was my favorite version of the deck for a long time. And so you can certainly build those decks in a lot of different ways. I guess Death Shadow might just be one of the bigger movers, Trey.
But just to bring it back to what Mason was talking about with Neoform, I think that one of the issues with that is that there's not, like, redundancy in the deck enough, right? Like you need Neoform. Like, you need the right stuff in order to, like, make stuff happen, as opposed to things like the Boar deck, right, where you have, like, Goryeo's Vengeance and Generator Servant and Boar and all of these different things that are, and Through the Breach, that are, like redundantly doing what it is that you're trying to do, right? Like, you can do all of this stuff in a way that, like, if one part of it gets disrupted, then you can still make stuff happen. And, like, the Neoform deck is like, well, you disrupted the one thing that I have. I don't have, like, another way that I do it. Like, this is all that I do.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at going to the SCG in Cleveland at the end of the month, and the Boar deck is the first one on my testing. Like, that was the thing I almost talked about. But I do think that, like, I think a lot of people are afraid about Neoform, and I'm totally willing to be wrong. I'm totally willing to be, like, in 2 months, like, oops, I was wrong. We got to do something about the deck. Allosaurus Rider. But I just don't think that's the case.
Well, and even Canister, who was the initial champion of the deck, has said on Twitter that it's not playable. Like, that he's, that it was fun, whatever, but that it's not an actual viable tournament deck.
Yeah. And maybe there's an evolution to that deck. I don't know it well enough to know, like, where I should be, like, looking to, like, level up my Neoform deck.
Maybe, like, an Eldritch evolution.
No, they play that card. So they got that one. I actually forgot they played that one, and someone cast it against me at the SCG. I was like, oops, forgot about that one. So that's his comment around that deck. I think, you know, it's just not a reasonable deck to play a 15-round tournament with. I think it's more reasonable if it was like 8 or less rounds. So
sure.
Yep.
Makes a lot of sense. Should we move on to our training rounds?
I'm ready.
So... no power rankings this week because there's a modern banning and standard hasn't happened yet.
Number one in modern, Faithless Looting. Number two, Path to Exile. Number three.
Number three, Faithless Looting.
Flashback Faithless Looting.
I think that you know, this could be one of those weeks where we could talk about Legacy. I personally haven't played Legacy in a hot minute. Wouldn't feel comfortable giving advice on the format. I know that there's some recent changes with Dreadhorde Arcanist in that format, but other than that, you know, I don't really know much about it. So
cards, the truth. That's what I've seen. I've watched a lot of Legacy recently. And like SCGs between rounds, and that card seems messed up. So,
yeah. So the Dreadhorde Arcanist happened in Legacy. There's your Legacy update. Let's go on to our training grounds this week, which is honing your strengths. So, you know, it was really funny. I was thinking about this, and Mason, like the next day, made a post in our Constructed Critics group about how always improving can sometimes be focused upon the things that you're doing wrong. And I want to read a line from a Forbes magazine article that I think explains why that happens. So it says, it was actually a Forbes article that specifically talked about, you know, honing your strengths versus attacking some of your weaknesses. And it says, in a nutshell, yet again, the evidence shows profoundly that recognizing and honing in a person's greatest strengths is far more effective than grinding on their greatest weaknesses. And it says, unless, of course, those weaknesses are a fatal flaw. So I think pretty often what happens is we get good at things in Magic, and then we can see these things that we're weak at that we can go attack and go do. And I think that sometimes, and a lot of times, if you think about the way Magic breaks down compared to other games, not actually fundamentally understanding how mono red or burn is going to attack you might be a fatal flaw in specific formats, right? So that's something you can go and attack. But a lot of the times we don't actually focus on, I'm good at this thing, let's be the best at this thing. And there are players that served really well, you know, Craig Wesco, Ali Antrazi,
Brian Kibler.
Brian, yeah,
I would say be the best in example. His earlier career, he like moved around much, but he really honed in his later career, I would say.
I mean, I think all of his Pro Tour top 8s are with green decks, so mm-hmm. I mean, it's something that can really work in Magic that we don't do enough because we feel bad when we don't know things, but it's okay as long as it's not that, you know, that fatal flaw. Do you guys have any thoughts on this quote?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's wrong to look at it as an either or, right? Like I think that it's not just a matter of honing your strengths. Like, you know, a guy like Craig Wesco, right, has a reputation of like he's always going to play white weenie, like always. And, you know, you get into questions about, like, expanding your range and doing things and what your goals are as a Magic player, and there's certainly things you can do. And, like, I think it would be wrong to look at this as you can only do this or only do that. But I think that one of the reasons that we want to talk about this is that so often we focus so much on the weaknesses, even though we're not trying to set it up as a only do one and not do the other. We, like, by default end up doing that in a way. And we're trying to focus on expanding our range or trying to pick up areas where we have leaks and doing things where we have problems in our game, and not like building on skill sets where we may have an advantage already or may have strengths. And so the important thing when we're looking at this and talking about is making sure that you don't swing the pendulum back the other direction too far and then ignore trying to increase your skill sets and things in areas where you're weak because you're now focusing on only doing what you're strong at. Like, and so it's important to try to find some kind of balance between the two things. But ignoring this one is just as much of a mistake as it would be to ignore weaknesses.
Yeah, for sure. You know, to use a workout analogy, because I go to the Temple of Iron so much, as you can tell. If you skip leg day a bunch, right, that's like not working on your fatal flaw. You're going to have problems there. But you still got to be able to do cardio and stuff like that. And if you're really good at cardio, that doesn't mean you should stop doing cardio, right? You still have to do that, and you can improve on those things too. And that thing could lead to being better in other categories as well. You know, for an example, in Magic, let's say you're really, really good at playing mid-range decks. You're like a Brad Nelson, right? Like, that's kind of like you really resonate with Brad. Brad likes mid-range decks. You like it. It really clicked with you. So you might have a really hard time playing something like an aggro deck. But those skills transfer between each other because getting better at Magic and improving on some of the fundamental things can go over there. So while you improve on those other categories, you can still be working on this other category that you're really strong at and getting better at that, and that can help you move up all the time. Because like Trey said, it's not, like most things in life, right, it's not black and white. Only Sith, Steel, and Absolute. So it's a bit of a gray there. But people, I think, don't focus, like Spencer said earlier, like I posted this in the group, they don't focus on what they're good at, and I think that leads to negative thoughts about themselves and also just not playing to their strengths when there are definitely moments where your strength is the right thing to do and you need to be able to play to it.
Yeah, I think one of the things when I look at this quote is there's a baseline for everything, right? At what point are you, quote, good at Magic? I listened to another podcast about Super Smash Bros. And they talked about how basically you shouldn't even try to learn advanced techniques to your character until you actually have the basics of Smash down. Like, these are the fundamentals of Smash. Go get these down and then go get good at something. And then be the best at that thing. And I think that's the same in Magic. Like, go become a fundamentally good Magic player and then decide what you enjoy about Magic and, you know, hone those things. And I think that we get lost in that because I think we on the podcast preach it, but I think people, including us sometimes, kind of warp that. It's about going back to the basics. Am I fundamentally sound right now? How can I improve my fundamentals? Is separate than how can I be the best mono red player in the world and the best blue white player in the world? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
I think that one of the things that when I look at a weakness in my game, it's typically a weakness in my fundamentals. It's typically a weakness in understanding those things. When I look at a strength, I look at that's different. If we look at the definition of strength, it says a good or beneficial quality about a person attribute. A good or beneficial quality or attribute of a person or thing. So what kind of strengths can you have in Magic, Mason?
I think a big one that people always kind of go to is understanding combat, seeing attacks and blocks, and kind of reading the battlefield. That's one. I think another strength is in deck building. Another strength is like looking at a metagame, being able to kind of break down what matters, what doesn't matter. I think another strength, honestly, that doesn't get talked about enough is being really good at mulliganing and kind of knowing what your deck's trying to do from like a big macro sense. Then there can be really good at micro decisions, like do I need to split my attacks here, do this. There's a lot of strengths in Magic. That's only when we're talking about Constructed. We're not even talking about Draft. We're not even talking about the stack. We're not even talking about like evaluating threats. There are so many things you can be good at in Magic.
A couple more to add on to that is I think that there are some people that are really good at playing while they're ahead, and then there are other people that I think are really good when they're playing it from behind. Like, and those, it may seem weird, but like those are different play styles and different skill sets. And I know, like, for me personally, like, I'm much better at playing when I'm behind than I am when playing when I'm ahead. Like, I've noticed that I put a lot more into it. I focus in a lot more. It was a thing I had to work on a lot to get the other way going. But like, you see players that definitely have a tendency or a preference as far as how that goes.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of those. When we look at the things that we can be good at Magic, Magic is one of those games that's so deep. And even understanding what fundamentals are in Magic is a whole nother podcast that we can do. Like, these are the fundamental things that you can be good at. And once you have those fundamentals down, I think that, you know, we can kind of move on to what we think our strengths are, because I think that can kind of inform players as to what theirs could be. You know, I've always found that I really enjoy tuning and brewing. I have a lot of success helping players get their decks ready for Pro Tours, you know, qualifying for Pro Tours off of decks that I've helped them build, and qualifying off of my own brew. And then, of course, you know, breaking down things into simple problems and throughout the game, a tactical way to attack Magic. That's one of the reasons I like mid-range decks so much, is because you can play the game more tactically versus strategically when you're breaking things down into those decisions with a mid-range deck. And, you know, that might not be the same. I think that I had to learn how to think more strategically when playing a control deck, for example. What is the strategy that's trying to attack me, and how can I combat that? And those are, so strategic versus tactical thinking is something that has become a strength of mine. What about you, Mason?
Yeah, I think one of my early strengths in Magic was I was pretty good at reading battlefield, so like attacking and blocking and that kind of stuff. And then kind of the opposite of yours, where it was like I was really good at like big strategic, like big picture thinking, right? Like, my deck is trying to ramp out a couple of threats, play a Flood of Tears, put Omniscience in play, then loop Tameo on Flood of Tears, and we're going to play the game to that. And all of our decisions are working towards that end game, right? Kind of like the same thing with Nexus does, something like that. I think those have been some of my strengths. I think another strength of mine is like a weird one when it comes to Magic, is that I'm not afraid to tackle a problem. While I acknowledge there are strategies that I'm not very good at and I think might be too hard for me, like a classic example that I always use is Burn and Dredge in Modern. I think those decks are really, really hard to play, at least for me personally. I can only get the perspective for myself in that kind of situation. So I try to, like, if I'm going to play that deck, I want to make sure it's the right deck, but I'm not afraid to play those decks if I think it's the right thing to do. I won't let something like that scare me. I think being willing to learn, I think, is actually a huge strength in Magic. Trey, what about you?
One of them I touched on already is I do think that I'm particularly good at playing while behind. I will often have a time that happens in games. It's like, well, this feels completely unwinnable, and I'll contemplate scooping or something, and then I'll start to think about it and see a line and be able to fight my way back through and win a lot of games that I don't feel like I have a lot of business winning from situations where I was really far behind. Second, I think that I'm pretty good at taking non-traditional decks or not necessarily like tier decks and finding ways to attack established metagames with them. Mason and I've had a fair amount of success so far doing that at various times, whether that was Approach of the Second Sun or, you know, during his last Standard season, I played a lot of Grixis that was not something that was really seeing a lot of play, and just finding ways to come at what the top tier decks are and attack them in a way that's off kilter or a little bit unexpected. And I've been able to do that to great success, and it's something that I've really leaned into and been able to build off of.
Yeah, I think that Trey, like me, and it's part of the reason why we clicked so quickly early on when we played Magic, is we're both big picture thinkers when it comes to Magic, right? Like, I would say that a lot of the decks we play lend themselves to the big end game plans I talked about, like with Flood of Tears and stuff. So
yeah,
and I think that's something that we share.
And then one additionally is that I generally in game have good patience. As far as like deploying spells and things like that, I'm not just going to play stuff just to play it, but like thinking about what it is that I'm playing towards and what it is that I'm doing, and, you know, certainly trying to deploy things and play things at an opportune time and not just playing into obvious situations for my opponent, like having patience around spells, and trying to utilize the resources that I have effectively is something that I think that I do well as far as like in game. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think of all the things that you notice yourself doing well. One that I didn't mention is I'm really good at reading my opponents. And that's just a separate skill from these fundamentals that we're talking about, right? Understanding, like, okay, because my opponent did this, this, and this, here's the things that they most likely have. It's just a skill that, you know, I always had in Magic once I knew the cards. And it's something that I don't think a lot of people know how to do. And one of the things that I want to touch on this is we've all talked about the things that we're good at, right? You know, Trey, how do you hone those skills that you talked about? How do you become better at playing from behind? How do you even take advantage of the skill of being good at playing from behind?
Yeah, it's something that started to happen organically, and it was mostly of like trying to stay focused in games where I didn't think that I had a chance to win. And then as I started doing that, I started realizing like what the things that I could play towards in my deck in order to try to win those games that seemed impossible. And then I had a couple of times come up where then those things happened and I played and won those games. And sometimes they were preposterous. Like, I won't get too much into the weeds on it, but like this was a time when Splinter Twin was in Standard. And I was playing against an opponent and I was impossibly far behind and I was playing Splinter Twin. And it's like, there were 20 people gathered around watching the match, and it's like, okay, I'm just going to concede because I don't really know what, there's not a way for me to win. And then I started thinking about it, and I'm like, okay, if my opponent makes the following 5 misplays and I draw these cards, then I can win. And then they made the first misplay that was necessary in the chain. And it's like, I just locked into like, okay, whatever, this is the plan. And it all played out and I won the game. And so then it just started, like, that was like a tipping point of like, okay, I need to start thinking about those situations in all of the games, like, and not just in this like crazy puzzle solving situation. But like, if I focus on that when it seems like I can't win, it's like, okay, it seems like impossible to win, but if I were going to win, how would it happen? And then once you start asking those questions, then you start pushing yourself to like try to make plays that like otherwise in a normal game might not be the right play. But you're like, well, I only win if these things happen. And so I just have to play to those things happening.
Yeah.
And it was something that, like I said, it kind of happened because I noticed in game situations, and then I got results from going down that direction. And so then I just kept pushing in that direction further and further.
Yeah, I think to like add on to this, it's one thing that you hear people talk about a lot is like, oh, when you lose the match, you sit there and you always think about what you did wrong, what you could have done better, right? Like every time you lose, like you see it happen all the time. If you're like looking at two people playing, you see the person one get up pretty quickly, you assume the other person lost a lot of the time, right? That's kind of like the trick to know if your friends are have won the round or not. And I think what happens is sometimes because you don't focus, you're not like always looking in and not always being introspective. When you win games, you're not thinking about that kind of stuff too. And one thing that, you know, I think I'm pretty good at also this in life is like being introspective, looking back on it. And that's kind of how I noticed and I started to hone that. It was like, oh, I won this game because I did this, right? And noticing these things. And so when you are introspective and not only defeat, but also in victory, right? And not like in a precocious way, but like thinking about like, how did I win that game? Or what went right for me in that game? Because there's always games like that where you're like, wait, how did I win that? And if you look back and think about that kind of stuff, you can kind of notice these strengths of yours and you're starting to see patterns emerge, right? And you're starting to see like, oh, I feel comfortable in these spots. I feel uncomfortable in these spots, right? If I got Lava Spike in my hand, I'm anxious. But if I've got Cast Down, I'm ready to go. So
yeah, and it's about that. That gets back to then too. You have to start trying to find like when the critical moments in the game were, mm-hmm. right? Like for when you won and when you lost, because it's not likely not the turn that you actually won and lost. Like things started to shift in your favor four turns before that, or shift away from you four turns before that because of something that happened or some decision that made, and like thinking about that and getting to the point of making like conscious like decisions and reflecting upon those moments. Are then the point that you can start to tip the scales one way or another when you're looking at playing when you're far behind.
Yeah, that's one example of that. Spencer, what about you?
You know, I think when I think about what has become my bigger strengths in Magic, you know, the two things really come to mind. The tuning aspect and the strategic versus tactical thinking aspect. You know, when I thought about the strategic and tactical part, this week when thinking about this podcast and when thinking about your post in the Conservative Critics group, one of my thoughts was, how did I start as a tactical thinker that became a strategic thinker, and now I have two strengths? And I think understanding the difference between strategic and tactical thinking was actually the biggest boon to all of it. Understanding that there is a clear difference between the two, and then approaching those and saying, okay, well, I'm going to break this down turn by turn, deck by deck, series by series, versus I'm going to understand my deck. I'm going to understand the metagame. And being able to see the difference actually really helps me to be able to do those things correctly. And also identify, you know, what I'm doing well in those things. I mean, like, okay, well, if I'm doing these well, let's, you know, put myself in the situations a lot. I think that mid-range decks do, for example, do a really good job of this, where you're able to do both sides of it really well. And so I put myself in the position to do that a lot, to be able to pivot, to be able, I mean, control X pivot too. And just, you know, put yourself in the position to do those things and you'll become better at them. I think about this in, I'm going to use Smash Bros. As an example again. You talk about people being in training mode in Smash Bros., right? Why do you playtest, Mason?
I playtest to kind of get a feel for things, understand how they work, and get an idea for it.
Right.
And so when those situations arise, I know what to do.
Right. So you're doing it to understand the strategy of the two decks pretty often. But once you get into the situations, with a lot of the times it becomes tactical and you actually have to break down the problem in that moment. And maybe that problem will come up again in the actual gameplay, but sometimes it won't. And there will be new problems and you'll have to kind of string things together tactically from the other situations that you've been in.
For sure. Yeah. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought of it, you know, in the analogy from Smash Brothers to Magic like that.
Yeah. And I think that in Smash Bros, like you're practicing specific combos, right? Well, how nobody's going to sit there and let you do that. You actually are just, you know, trying to understand the fundamental parts and then execute them when you can in the best way that you can. I think playtesting in Magic is the exact same. You know, what is this deck strategy? What is my deck trying to do? And then once you understand that strategy, you can take tactical advantage of it.
Yeah, for sure. That makes a lot of sense. And I do think that's something that, you know, if you're listening at home and that doesn't sound like something that, like, that's like maybe a foreign concept to you, right? Where that sounds like something that's like out of reach, or like, for to use a meme, big brain. These are things that you can like work on and you can improve at. And the first step of getting good at something is to try something, right? And to try and tackle the problem. So I think that is, you know, definitely something that is important. One thing that I think we kind of all mentioned, which is interesting, is we all said we're pretty good at like attacking a metagame and like looking at a metagame, figuring out what matters. What is like the way you go about that? Because I know that's something that for a lot of players, they're like, I just don't understand. I don't know. And so what I do is I trust that, you know, Jim Davis, Emma Handy, Tannen Grace, they're like, they're going to do the work. I'm going to read their articles. I'm going to trust what they're saying, which is a totally great plan. Don't get me wrong, but it's a skill that you could work on. So like, how is something that, you know, we all feel that we're good at, we feel qualified to talk about. How do you go about that?
Well, I think that one of the things that you first have to do is that, like, whatever the decks are that are at the top of the metagame, like, you have to fundamentally understand what it is that they're trying to do. Like, you know, it's one thing to know that, like, Nexus is a top deck, and it's another thing to know, like, what it's doing, what its game plan is, what it is that it's trying to accomplish, versus, say, like, you know, mono red versus, like, a Gruul midrange deck, or, like, whatever. Like, you have to be able to figure out, like, what the pieces are, what their goals are, and what, you know, everything is going on. Like Hogak in Modern is a great example, right? Like, before the banning, it's like, oh, this is like a Dredgevine deck, and it's about bringing Vengevines back, and then you play against it, and you get milled out, and you're like, oh, I didn't know that that's what it was about. Like, and so, you know, the first step, I think, in trying to, like, attack a metagame, or, like, understand a metagame, is that you have to spend the time, like, figuring out what the purposes are, and the roles are, and the tools that these decks are doing, and what it is that they're trying to accomplish. Which there's no shortcut to, it just takes time. Like, you have to, like, look at them, you have to read about them, you have to see games of them, you have to try stuff out, like, you have to get a feel for, like, what all of the different decks that are seeing a lot of play are doing.
I just wanted to, I think we can actually break this down pretty easily in an example for you, Mason. So your first SCG finish that I could find was the four color gates deck, right? You took 20th place. How many Nexus of Fate decks do you think were in top 8?
I think it was 0 that weekend, or maybe it was 1.
It was like, 0. How many do you think were in the top 25?
I think it was, there were 3 in day 2. I remember that because it was Dylan Hand, somebody, and I watched Dylan, the other person, get played, and I was like, thank goodness. Oh, there was definitely 3 because I played against Kane Reinhardt, my teammate at this last SCG. I met him there. So I beat one of them. So there were definitely 3.
Yeah, there was 0 in the top 25.
Oh, there's 0 in the top 25? Okay.
Yes. So, it's pretty easy to see why you had success with the Gates deck. You also probably didn't think that Nexus was a great choice going into that weekend.
Yeah, otherwise, I just didn't.
Yeah, and so you were right. Why did you think that?
Because I thought people would be trying to do proactive stuff like red, or the midrange deck should be prepared from the gates. I also just didn't. I didn't believe in Wilderness Reclamation. That's the I was wrong about it. Was I thought I was like, Wilderness Reclamation is probably not as good as people think it is. You can attack this. You can negate it. And that's honestly what I did when I played against them. I was like, well, I'm just never tapping out. You know, if you could play Wilderness Reclamation.
Just so happened, a lot of the best decks that people brought were Sultai midrange decks. They, you know, did really, really well. And that was kind of the story of that tournament, right? You didn't play Gates long after that because of Wilderness Reclamation. Yep. You identified Wilderness Reclamation as a problem card for this deck, and as people discovered its power, you came off of the deck. Why did that happen?
Yeah, because it's a bad choice. That and Mono Blue, where like two Predators were rising up against me.
Yeah. Mono Blue was good against Sultai, right? The rise of Mono Blue attacking Sultai was really bad for Gates. You know, and then with that, Wilderness Reclamation also started to get a little bit better. It started to figure out how to attack the different style of decks that were attacking it and attacking the hate, bringing Gates down. And this is just a small example of times where, you know, I think both you and I were really, really high on Gates at this time, and both almost immediately at the same time jumped off of Gates. I think the next example in the green-red decks is another really good example. Immediately, my first impression of that deck was, we can't play this deck, it can't beat Nexus. And then I played with Cindervines one time, and I was like, oh, wait, maybe I can play this deck. So, you know, understanding, like Trey said, to break down what are the problems I'm trying to attack in the metagame, and then what problems would my deck have with those things. And it, and then you kind of, in your head, you like, maybe it's like a fake, I mean, that's, I want to say a spreadsheet, but that's like kind of weird. But you kind of just check off the boxes. Okay, I can beat this, I can beat this, I can't beat this, I can beat this, I can't beat this. I had a post this week about Gates in the Constructed Critics groups. And basically it was like, I'm pretty comfortable playing this deck. I don't think that I can beat Nexus. And I want to know, first of all, I don't think I should care. I don't think that Nexus is a deck that people are going to bring to Denver. I think that it's very likely that I play Scapeshift. You know, I think that is good against the rest of the field. Why, at what point do your checks and balances say this is something I can do? And how do you hone that skill, Mason?
I think personally for me, it's a lot of A, faith in yourself, and B, just doing and trusting the process, kind of like what we talked about, right? Like, for example, you know, let's talk about Gates going into this weekend, right? Next weekend for Denver. Assuming we have to play it like this weekend, right? It's like, well, everyone agrees Nexus is really strong, right? Everyone's going to try and attack Nexus. There are other decks out there that are also really strong. Everyone really likes these Risen Reef decks. Everyone really likes these mid-range decks. And no one's going to show up to that tournament and not have a plan for Nexus. Part two, and this is kind of another factor, is, and I think you have to consider this stuff within reason, and decks like this show it, is that Nexus is a miserable tournament experience, and people don't want to experience that. A lot of people are going to have one GP a year, especially in Denver, where unfortunately, geographically, you don't get a lot of events. And are you really going to go to your one GP that year and not play the awesome Risen Reef deck, or are you going to play this boring Nexus deck? And I think that honestly plays into it, too. I think that's something that I don't put a lot of weight in, but it's something I put weight in. Furthermore... Yeah,
but I think that's something that we think about a lot and we talk about. Like, is this experience fun? Because people want to have fun when they're at the tournaments, even spiky people.
Yeah, I think a great example of this, to use a story, is during the height of KCI, Matt Nass, Sam Pardee, and Andrew Beckstrom, probably three of the best KCI players in the world, flat out. Matt Nass, definitely, right? Those three lived in an apartment complex together. They played the deck daily. It was clearly the best deck in the metagame. They knew it.
Sam Pardee broke it.
Yeah, for sure. And it was like right in the height of its power. It's like maybe a month before the BNR. Sam Pardee shows up to a tournament playing Spirits. And when asked, why am I playing Spirits? Sam Pardee says, it sounded a lot more fun than playing KCI all day, even if I think I could top 8 with KCI. Sam Pardee is a gold pro and a platinum pro for the last 5 years before this. He is an insane spiky player. Even he said, I do not want to play the best deck. This stuff just happens. So I don't want to get too derailed on that. I just wanted to use it as a point that stuff does matter a little bit.
And also just understanding that those things come into play helps us in these decision makings. You know, we all say that we're good at this thing, but I think it's because, one, I think it comes from experience. You know, it's something, you know, I've shown up with a couple of bad decks at tournaments. I'm not going to pretend like I haven't, right? Like,
raise your hand if you play the bad deck at a tournament.
Yeah, absolutely.
Say your cat first RPTQ. Let's go.
I'm not going to pretend that I haven't done it. But, like, do I have more hits than misses? I think so. You know, and I think... Go ahead, Trey.
Well, just another way to try to think about, you know, because you were doing a good job, I think, walking through breaking it down, like, to help give listeners tools of a thing to look at. Like, we can use the example that you were using, right? You've got this Scapeshift deck, and it's not good against Nexus. And so, but you're well configured against what you think the rest of the field is going to be. Okay, great. So now you have a clearly identified problem. So then the next step in the process is, then what would I have to do in the sideboard to dedicate to beating that matchup, right? Or main deck, whatever. Like, but you don't want to mess up your configuration that's good against the rest of the field. Sure. Like, you've got, like, okay, I'm good against the field, I'm bad against this one deck. So what tools do I have available to me in the colors that I'm in and the deck that I'm in that can beat that deck? And then you start looking at that, and it's like, okay. And so then you're testing and you're testing and you're testing, and it's like, how much do you have to dedicate to that one matchup? And then you start to have to ask yourself the next question, is that what equity am I losing and sacrificing against other matchups in order to beat this one? And then you have to weigh what it's going to cost you to improve a matchup that's bad versus what it is that you're losing against the metagame as a whole. And then you have to make decisions about that. And sometimes you have to make a decision of, like, look, I'm not going to bother. I'm just going to try to dodge Gates, or I'm going to try to dodge Nexus or whatever, because in order for me to actually have a reasonable chance of beating it with this deck, I need to dedicate like 7 sideboard card slots to it. Yeah. And it's not worth it.
I think the important part is to actually do what you said, though, right? You know, one of the things that I so often hear people say is like, oh yeah, I played against this deck six times and, you know, I knew I had a bad matchup going in. And I just thought I tried to dodge it. And it'll be like in those weeks where it's like, well, this was going to be 20% of the meta. What else did you, like, you just were trying to avoid one in five people at this tournament in a 15-round event. Like, you were going to play against it four times. And in order to, it kind of go back to Mason's example, right? In order to get better at something, you have to do that thing. You can't just say, well, I'm already good at this, so now I can just dodge people. No, yeah. Like the math doesn't actually add up that way. You still actually have to try and build the best deck that you can for each given event, and you'll get better at picking and building for those things when you do those things that we're talking about.
Yeah. I want to add two things to this because I think this is a lot of good stuff, but there's things I want to say real quick. So going on that example of like picking a deck and you're like, ah, well, I'm supposed to dodge it. And you hear someone say, I played against this deck six times. The first thing I immediately thought of was friend of the show, Teresa Foe. I love you, Teresa, but we went to NCG Indianapolis and she played against Nexus six times and complained about Nexus the whole time. And then we got back to the Airbnb and she was like, how do I fix the Nexus matchup? And I'm like, Teresa, you just got like, you hit the unlucky pot. You took all the Nexus players from me. Thank you so much. I'm into day two at X and one now. But, you know, like, that's not a thing that's really going to happen to you. And she's like, no, I need like cyborg cards. My deck's unplayable, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Nexus isn't that great. Just play your same deck tomorrow. Let's make this one change. This cyborg card seemed really bad. Let's put in the Cinder Vines. That way you have something for Nexus, right? And let's, like, just play that. And then she got top 32 in the Classic, but she scooped the last round to go home to hang out with her boyfriend. So she almost got top 16. She was playing a good matchup. She just had to scoop because of time, right? Sure. But knowing to trust yourself, and she was willing to trust the process and everything, be like, I got unlucky. So being able to look at that, right, and be able to look back at the tournament. And when we look back at that tournament, it's like, hey, Nexus wasn't that great of a pick for that weekend, right? Teresa just got unlucky. And so when you have these experiences and it seems like, I thought Nexus was going to be terrible. I thought it wouldn't be playable. I thought people wouldn't enjoy it. And I got paired against it six times. It's like, well, did it play out that Nexus was really strong? Did it play out that Nexus was really good? And the answer is no. And I'm sorry that you got a little unlucky and that stuff happens. But you also signed up to play Magic the Gathering, so welcome to the grind, you know? Now, part two to what I wanted to say about all this is also thinking about the types of tournaments you're going to, right? This happens, I think, a lot when I play a lot of IQs nowadays, and I played a lot of PPTQs before. I play a lot of these local events where you get people from across your state coming to play one thing. And what happens is everyone's like, I'm on Magic Twitter. I'm on SCG. I'm reading SCG, SCFB. And I know Hogak is the best deck in the metagame. And I have 9 cards for Hogak in my 75, which, to be fair, in this one example, was probably correct. But most of the time, it's not right to have 9 cards for Hogak. In fact, this was a real argument I had with myself and with my teammates going to the SCG, was that I don't think I should play this many hate cards. I don't think I need to. And I probably actually would have done better at the SCG if I didn't play so many hate cards. But that's another conversation for another day. What does matter is that people play all these events, right? And when you play these small tournaments, people just aren't going to have the cards, right? Like, they aren't going to switch decks. They aren't going to buy this Hogak deck for this IQ. And so it's like, okay, I'm going to bring a deck that can, like, beat Hogak, because I'm probably going to have to beat Hogak if I'm going to win the tournament. It's still a really good deck, but I'm not going to play something ridiculous. A great example of this is I played an IQ 2 weeks after Hogak was busted. Everyone in that room told me I came with a bunch of Hogak cards, a bunch of Hogak hate cards. I played Jeskai Cat. That deck cannot beat Hogak in a million years. My plan against Hogak, Trey can back me up here, was for them to get unlucky and for me to not get paired against them. In top 8, I got paired against Hogak. I was told from a friend who played Jeskai Cat and switched off because he couldn't beat Hogak going into the tournament, who actually played test against this guy a whole bunch the day before, that you can never win the matchup. So when my hand was double spreading seas some lands and they're on the play and they mulliganed, I go, well, this is the best chance I got. So I kept, and then when they mulled to 5, I spreading seas them out of the game. It slowed them down enough. So knowing what to do in those kind of situations and knowing like how to play your matchups matters. So like, knowing that, like, this isn't the thing I'm going to run into. And then at the tournament, there was only, like, 2 Hogak players, which is part two. It's like a 50-person tournament, 2 Hogak players. Well, things that aren't going
to
show up.
And this touches on a thing, like, to bring back, like, you know, the thing that I was saying and then what, Mason, you were just talking about. Something that happens a lot, and I see this a lot in Modern, where, like, somebody's building a sideboard for whatever their deck is, and they'll have, like, 1 Tormod's Crypt. Or 1 Grafdigger's Cage. Or 1
Stony Silence.
1 Stony Silence, or whatever, but it's like... And it's like, you're looking at their list and like, what do you think about this list? It's like, what is that? Like, what is that for? What's your plan? And it's like, well, I need a sideboard card for Dredge. And I'm like, that's not going to beat Dredge. Like, you're not making a plan to beat Dredge. You're just throwing a card in your sideboard so that you have a sideboard, quote-unquote, plan for every deck. And what you would be doing better is that if you were thinking about it from a matchup standpoint, and just be like, look, I don't have enough slots to dedicate to Dredge, so screw it. I'm just not going to put sideboard cards in here for Dredge. I'm going to put sideboard cards in here for other things. Right? Like, that's a fine decision to make. But, like, I see people get into that thing where they're like, I've got to have a sideboard card. Like, I need one Cinder Vines for Nexus. And it's like, I mean, is there a better card that you should be playing and just, like, act like Nexus doesn't exist? Like, you know, you don't just come to that decision haphazardly. You have to walk through the steps that we've been talking about. But, like, you don't have to have cards to bring in against every deck. Like, you don't have to have things that you've dedicated to that. What you have to do is you have to make decisions about what the metagame is, and then you have to make decisions about what you're willing to sacrifice when you're putting your stuff together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of to go back all the way before the start of this part of the conversation, mm-hmm. to how do we own these skills? I think the first step that people need to kind of, if you're going to take have an action item leaving this podcast, what are your strengths? And then, you know, brainstorm for a minute. What are you going to do in the next 2 weeks to hone them? And then check in. You know, what are the things that you can do to put yourself in the situation to enter training mode on these skills? And I think that that will be a huge help to you as a player to, I mean, obviously the whole going through all of these steps in the decision-making of the skill that we all thought we're decent at. Hopefully that helps you understand, like, the process that it takes to even have, to say, this is a skill of mine. Here's how I do it. And I think that if you can say that about attacking and blocking, if you can say that, about different aspects of magic, you'll probably be able to identify situations that you can put yourself in to improve with them.
Yeah, and I think the key component that's like bled through all of the discussion that we've had over this episode, it all comes back to self-reflection. And like, if you're taking those steps and looking at your game like Spencer was talking about, and you're looking at yourself, then you're already on the right track to getting to the points that we're talking about. But like, that's the initial first step, and then that step doesn't stop. Like, you just have to always do that all the time. And it's admittedly exhausting, but it's what is necessary in order to like continually to hone and improve. Like, you know, you just think about it like a blade. You know, Mason said he wanted a sword earlier. Like, blades get dull. You have to sharpen them. And if you don't sharpen them, then they just get dull.
Yep. No, I think that's a really good point. Like, if you just hack at something for hours on end, you know, it's gonna stop working. Like, you've gotta hone the knife, so to speak. So
if you don't use it, you lose it. That's right. Like the math teacher says, like in fifth grade, right? It's like, if you don't use the math, you're going to lose it. And nowadays, I can't do algebra. So who was right?
Your math teacher sounds kind of creepy.
Yeah.
Also, your math teacher was right. I think that is going to do it for this week. It was a fun episode. I'm glad that we got to talk about this topic. Be positive about yourself. I think one of the things that a lot of people listening to this podcast oftentimes miss is if you're listening to this, you're probably self-reflective enough to realize that you're good at parts of magic, and that if you want to be better, there's a reason you want to be better. It's because you had some success and thought, this is fun. I like winning. I want to win more. And once you have that, I think that you'll be able to find what was causing you to win and be able to move forward from that. So, people find me at Spencer13H. People can find Mason at Mason E. Clark. You can find Trey at Trey MC. You can find the podcast at CCMPG and every week on constructorcriticism.com and YouTube. Did I say the Twitter handle? I don't even know.
You said, I was about to say, you didn't mention this was all on Twitter. All our at Twitter names.
Everyone knows what at means, Mason.
Well, it could be an Instagram, right?
Oh. That's fair.
Nobody ever talks about Magic Instagram. It's Magic Twitter. Everybody knows.
By the way, I wanted to mention that real quick. You should probably be on Magic Twitter if you want to see like deck lists and stuff get shared. And it's like pretty important. If you're not on there and you're like, man, where do I find this stuff? Magic Twitter.
Also, Magic Twitter is a wild ride. You're going to want to be on it.
And sometimes you're going to really not want to be on it.
Sometimes you'll just shut off your phone for a hot minute.
Yeah.
Be like, yeah, that was good. I'm done.
Yeah, sometimes you block the word faithless looting for 48 hours. Sometimes these things happen.
yeah, you can find the rest of the shows on the network. There's new shows coming out. You know, we got 10th Street Hooligans coming onto the network. You know, Adam Spain doing his thing. Common Knowledge is really doing well. If you're trying to get into Popper, that is a show that I highly recommend. And then I started a new show called Mythicast, a weekly show about the ladder grind of the decks that people are using to get there. So
yeah, and the Teamfight Tactics podcast is coming next week, right? With me and Kling. We're going to call it the TFT Cabal. That's the name.
You guys go for it. Hashtag always improving.
Let's go.
And then also don't forget that if you want to support the show, check out our sponsor, Wasteless Games. Check out the Patreon. And then there, as always, you know, you can go to constructedroom.com, buy some swag. You know, we try and price the swag, so we just get a little bit, and you get to support the show just by, you know, wearing stuff to events. So should we talk about hashtag? Would that be good?
Yeah, hashtag that would be good as a Twitter outreach program. If you tweet it, we will read it. So you see, you need to be on Magic Twitter. Or just Twitter. You know, Magic Twitter is just a subsection of Twitter. That way we can read your things. Like this beautiful thread. At Thomas Bitter tweeted, I didn't think the ad last week could be top, but I was wrong. Well done, CCMGG. Spencer, when I get paid next week, I'm going to become a patron. Then, at LawbookMTG tweeted, we all missed the WoWK segment, so I love that the ad essentially became a WoWK. I don't know what a WoWK segment is, but I like the idea that there's something out there that at least Ellison thought we were talking about. Spencer says that back in the day, we had a segment called Stop It, where Casey Bloodworth and I would tell people to stop it. Thomas Bitter says, you should bring that back, and then Spencer leads us back to the hashtag, would that be good? That way, I had to read this whole Twitter thing out loud, because if you tweet it, Mason will read it. And then, this is what happens when you abuse that power. I read the whole Twitter thread on the podcast, and I'm sure some people got lost and confused.
No, the ads have been great, by the way. Oasis really loves them. But wow, okay, man. Like, you really gonna, like, dagger me like that?
Thanks, everybody, for saying really nice things about the ads. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, these are true stories that we're reading, so.
Yeah, it's true.
Yep.
I mean, you know, the origins of them were read the week that I wasn't here. I mean, Mason leaked it to the whole world. He told everyone the secret location of the ads, and I'm still catching a lot of heat for that.
Yep. Yeah. At Couch Troll Brewing Luke tweeted, best pre-release ever. While I was floundering around in the O2 bracket, my nephew finished off his day undefeated. First time for my nephew to go undefeated on FNM. We're pre-release event. Congratulations, Cam. Hashtag, would that be good?
I don't know if the mic is picking it up, but I'm applauding.
It definitely would be good.
It's awesome.
Get it some jazz snaps.
Ooh, yeah.
I like it. A little hashtag, AMSR.
Hashtag take note.
Yeah, I think you did a great job.
Oh, man, I missed my Yeti for that reason and that reason only. All my sweet AMSR videos that never came out. At MythicCast tweeted, this week's episode is up. At Spencer13H sits down with at YoMan5, friend of the show, I should say, to talk about his take on Gateshift, a ramp deck that uses Gates and Scapeshift to win the game. Hashtag, would that be good? Now I'm going to read the YouTube link. YouTube.com.
No, please don't.
I'm just joking. Please don't. Yeah, so Spencer, you did an episode with YoMan5 on the Gate Life.
Dude, honestly, this podcast has been really rewarding.
Which podcast? This podcast or the other podcast?
Both are great. One of them I get to talk to Trey. One of them I don't get to talk to Trey. You know, so there's benefits. There's not benefits. But I got a message that was really heartfelt. That was, hey, thank you so much for what you're doing for the Magic community, putting a spotlight on the community rather than on yourself to really help people both, you know, share their experiences with the world, and, you know, be a part of a bigger thing. And it was just a really cool message to get. So,
yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah. But if you want to hear about the Mythic Life, check out Mythicast.
There you go.
And that's going to do it for this week, everybody. So thank you so much for listening. And we'll talk to everybody next week with another episode of Constructed Criticism.